Welcome to Next on the Tee with Chris Mascaro, where tour players, legends, and the top instructors in the game share their stories, insights, and playing lessons. Join Chris every week as he talks with the greats of the game.
You are the smartest guy I've spoken to on radio or television in my career.
And Chris, again, you're knocking out of the park. You're like 8 under par in this interview.
By having any research, I'm hiring your tail to be the research man. You're the best.
You're a fantastic host and tremendously respected in the golf community.
Yeah, Chris, you do an amazing job, and your listeners are super lucky to have you, and it's always my pleasure.
Chris Mascaro is the king of the golf podcast. Don't miss him on Tuesdays.
Now, here's your host, Chris Mascaro.
Hello, folks, and welcome into part two of this week's edition of Next on the Tee. I'm your host, Chris Mascaro, and I couldn't be more excited and privileged to get to spend some time in these two segments with two former PGA Tour pros. Great guys, one making his Next on the Tee debut. Leading off with me is going to be a guy who played in the mid to late 1970s, then decided to leave professional golf and go back to school and get his medical degree, ultimately becoming one of the country's leading orthopedic surgeons, and that's Bill Mallon. Bill won 43 amateur titles during the early part of his playing career, earned his way through Q School in 1975, played in the 1977 U.S. Open. We're going to hear about all of those experiences, plus what it was like playing in the golden age of the PGA Tour against the likes of Jack Nicklaus, Tom Watson, Lee Trevino, Gary Player, all of those fantastic players from the 1970s. Then we'll switch gears a little bit, and I'll get his medical opinion about what Tiger is dealing with and trying to play through. What are his thoughts on the fusions and what toll that might be taking on the other parts of Tiger's body? Really looking forward to having Bill back as part of the show. He'll join me here in just a few moments. Following him, like I say, making his Next on the Tee debut is going to be Scott Gump. Scott played his way up through the pro golf ranks, winning out on the Space Coast Tour and the Corn Ferry Tour. He was the medalist at the 1987 U.S. Amateur during the stroke play portion of that tournament. That got him into the 1988 Masters. We're going to hear about all of those things, plus several of his top 10 finishes, including a run that he had in 1991 at the International Tournament and the Walt Disney World Classic. Looking forward to having Scott as part of the show. He's going to join me about 25 minutes from now. So again, a lot of fun in store for you in part two of this week's show. Thank you so much for tuning in and taking the journey with me. As always, we're going to have a lot of fun here over the next hour or so. But before we get started, as I've been saying to you guys all season long, our resident director of instruction, Tom Patry, and I have been working with a company called Kickpoint, and they have done some magical things with our logos and created some polo shirts with some wonderful designs where they take our logos and turn them into designs on a polo shirt. They're absolutely outstanding. Kickpoint Golf is a private label custom golf apparel company making bespoke polo shirts, quarter zips, and hoodies for those selected clubs looking to take their branded game to a whole new level. If you want to check out their apparel, and again, it's going to knock your socks off, send an email to info@kickpointgolf.com. They'll get right back to you. There's no middleman. They're going to go right to the guys that do this work. You're going to check it out, and you are really going to love what they do. I'm going to start showing the polo shirts that they designed for me on my Instagram, @CTMascaro. Check them out there so you can get a sample of what they look like. These guys know where it's at. Now let's talk about golf getaways and buddy's trip locations. When you're thinking about that, think about our friends over at the Macklemore, which is a wonderful resort located just south of Chattanooga, Tennessee, high atop Lookout Mountain. It is a casual two-hour drive from Atlanta, Nashville, and Birmingham. The existing Highlands course is now ranked in the top 100 courses you can play in the U.S. by Golf Digest. The 18th hole is ranked in the top 10 finishing holes in the world. A second course, The Keep, is under construction and will open summer of 2024. The Keep is a Bill Bergen, Reese Jones design and features a mile and a half of dramatic cliff edge, with every inch of that edge filled up with a golf hole. A world-class hotel, Cloudland Lookout Mountain Curio Collection by Hilton, will open spring of 2024. Both have incredible views into historic Macklemore Cove, 1,200 feet below. You got to see it to believe it, folks. Stay, dine, and play golf above the clouds at Macklemore. Go online to macklemore.com to book your stay and play package. Now let's talk about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade. From the very beginning, P790 irons have been rooted in clean aesthetics and thoughtful design. However, their true beauty is found beneath the surface. With AI-optimized weighting and speed foam air on the inside, every iron is uniquely designed to perform exactly how you need it to. As striking as they are on the outside, their true beauty lies within. Learn more about the new P790 irons from TaylorMade by checking out their website at TaylorMadeGolf.com. Okay, now back in Next on the Tee with me is Bill Mallon. Bill is from Paterson, New Jersey, grew up in Framingham, Massachusetts, and later moved down to Raleigh, North Carolina. His father was a competitive cyclist. Bill attended Duke University and played on the men's golf team, where he lettered from 1970 to 73, helped them to top six finishes all 4 years he was there in the ACC Championship. He was named a Ping GCAA All-American in 1972 and 73, and was twice voted to the Outstanding College Athletes of America. Individually, he finished tied for sixth in the 1972 ACC Championship and fourth in 73. He won 43 amateur titles, including the Massachusetts and New England Amateur Championships twice, and one Mid-Atlantic title. He also won the New England Open in back-to-back years of 1976 and 77. He went through Q School and earned his tour card in 1975, and he played on the tour through 1979. His best finish was a tied for fifth at the 1977 Tucson Open. He played in the 1977 U.S. Open at Southern Hills. And following his PGA Tour career, he went back to Duke and earned his medical degree and is now an orthopedic surgeon. And he's been the medical editor for Golf Digest since the late 1980s. He's also an Olympic historian. He's written several books on the topic and co-founded the International Society of Olympic Historians. And I couldn't be more honored. I get to have him back with me again this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Bill, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me. I think I just learned some stuff about myself. Jeez, that was a lot of stuff.
Indeed it is. Bill, I want to start out our time this time around by talking about your relationship with your caddy, Chris Greeley. I read that he was introduced to you prior to the 1973 Massachusetts Amateur, which you guys won together. Talk about your meeting and working with Chris.
Well, 73, I was probably the favorite. I was probably the best player in the state by then. And it was a Belmont Country Club where Chris had grown up caddying. And he was the number one caddy. He'd caddied there for years. So he got his choice and he picked me to caddy for the week. And he did. And we won the tournament. And he was a great guy, a great caddy. I really liked him. And he was at that time a student at BU, Boston University. And he had played on the hockey team. One thing a lot of people don't know about Chris was he played on the hockey team with about four or five guys that later played for the U.S. Olympic team in 1980. But Chris tore up his knee and had to give up hockey. And I asked him if he'd want to come caddy for me. So he did.
All right. So I'm a huge fan of the 80 Olympic team. You got to tell who are some of the guys he played alongside him?
Ruzzioni. Everyone knows Michael Ruzzioni. Jim Craig. And Jack O'Callaghan, I think one of my prized possessions, Chris got, this was after I left the tour, but Chris got a hockey stick signed by the BU guys from that Olympic team, and I've got it. So,
wow.
Probably worth something, actually.
I'm sure it is. Bill, I'm curious, like between shots, whether it was Chris or with any of the caddies that you worked alongside of, did you like to, were you silent when you were walking between shots? Did you like to talk to your caddy? Did you and Chris like to talk Red Sox and other sports stories? What did you prefer? How'd you like to handle it?
Well, I was relatively intense when I was playing. I was fairly quiet, but I did talk to Chris. He's a good guy. We got some laughs. We had a good time. Chris is from just outside Boston, and there weren't a lot of guys from New England on tour. One of the other guys on tour, another caddy, was a guy named Mike Cowan, better known as Fluff. And Chris and Fluff became good friends because of the New England connection. and not very well known, but Fluff caddied for me about two or three times over the years in various Monday qualifiers when Chris wasn't around and stuff. So I always jokingly tell people that I taught Fluff everything I knew, and then he taught it to Tiger Woods. And
that's great. I read a story, you know, sticking with Chris, that he was really good at math, but one time he gave you a yardage from the wrong sprinkler head, and you sailed your shot 50 yards over the green, and he said, "Get it up and down for me, pro." Yeah. You remember that situation?
Oh, yeah. It was the 16th hole at Charlotte, where they now play the Wells Fargo there at Quail Hollow. And there was a bunker in back of the green. And I remember he told me the yardage. I can't think of it. I'm looking at this thing. I go, that's like a wedge or a nine iron I got left. And by the yardage he gave me, it looked like it sounded like a six iron. And he talked me into it. I don't know why I listened to him on that one. I shouldn't have. But I hit a six iron, hit it easy, hit it fat, and flew it over the bunker in back of the green. And that's when he told me to get it up and down.
So. Bill, when you were out there on the PGA Tour, it's what many of us consider to be the golden age of the tour. It was in the heyday of Jack Nicklaus and Tom Watson, Gary Player, Lee Trevino, Johnny Miller. Arnold Palmer was still out there playing, and a lot of legends were coming up in the game at that time. What was it like for you being inside the ropes with players like that?
Well, I mean, it was great. I mean, you know, it was a childhood dream. That's what I wanted to do. I still miss that part of it. You know, I didn't get to play with a lot of those guys. I never played with Nicklaus or Johnny Miller. I did play with Gary Player quite a bit. He and I became relatively friendly because I worked out a lot, and Gary did too. So we'd work out together. But yeah, it was great. You know, I always jokingly used to tell people, you know, that Nicklaus always said he planned his schedule around the major championships. I said, yeah, I did that too. I didn't get invited to the Masters. I didn't usually qualify for the U.S. Open or the PGA, and I never went and played in the Open Championship. So I was scheduled right around the major championships.
Speaking of working out, I'm curious. We've all seen and heard about, you know, the big tour workout facilities to travel with them from place to place, and all the trailers and the trainers and all of that sort of thing. Back then, it might have just been you and Gary Player working out. There wasn't a lot of thought of using weights and being in shape like they are today. What was it like out on tour trying to work out back then?
Well, first of all, you know, we didn't have any money, so I drove a lot of places. I drove my car to a lot of the tournaments because they didn't, you know, now every player in the tournament gets a courtesy car. Back then, they only gave the courtesy cars to like the top 10 money winners or 20 or something like that. So I needed a car to get around, or else I'd have all the extra expense of renting a car every week. So I carried stuff with me. I had some weights in the car and I did that. You know, I started that because the knock on me, I was about 5'10", not anymore, but I was about 5'10" and pretty skinny in high school. And the knock on me as a junior player was I didn't hit it far enough to play at a pro level. And I, you know, several people told me that and I heard that. So I started lifting weights when I was in high school, to try and get stronger. And I did. I got a lot stronger. And by the time I got on tour, I wasn't one of the longer hitters, but I was probably longer than average. So, you know.
So working out with weights helped you gain a little distance. Talk about that whole piece, because how much did getting stronger and working out, I'm guessing, you know, all parts of your body, how much did that gain, and how much of it was swing and technique?
I'd say it was three things. It was probably, you know, the weight lifting. I lifted all through college, and, you know, I remember when I was in the weight room at Duke, one of the football players came over to me like at the end of my sophomore year. And he said, "Hey, the football guys have noticed you're in here all the time. They really think that's great." And I said, I was the only one doing it from the golf team. Also technique, you know, my swing got more and more grooved and I could gain club head speed. The third thing that probably helped was, you know, I was kind of young, graduate high school. I graduated just after I turned 17 years old. So, you know, I was younger than a lot of people in college. I was always the youngest kid in my class. And I just matured a little later, and probably the testosterone storm of, you know, kind of going through a later puberty probably helped me. I mean, helped me get longer, that is.
When I take a look at the clubs that I know that I played back in the 70s and the 80s, the old Persimmon Woods and things like that, when you look at the head of a driver, a three wood, particularly a four wood and a five wood, I'm almost astounded that anybody could square up those clubs and hit the golf ball the way you look at the clubs nowadays. I mean, the head on a four wood and a five wood isn't even as big as, you know, a couple of your fingers. You look back at that sort of thing, are you stunned what we used to play with?
No, because I did it, you know. I'm stunned when I look at the clubs now and see how big they are. You know, I talked to, at the 2016 Olympics in Rio de Janeiro, I bumped into Gary Player, and Gary and I got to spend a little time together. And I don't play a lot anymore, but Gary was telling me, he says, it's hard to hit the clubs offline now because they're so big and they've got such a, you know, large center of gravity on the outside. And he was just telling me about that. And I can see that. We played what we had available, and we did it, you know.
Yeah. In June of 1976 at the Western Open, you had one of your best tournaments. You finished sixth, only three strokes behind eventual winner Al Geiberger. Must have been a brutal final round, though, because when I look at the scores, Bob Dixon, who was leading going into the final round, shot 80 that day. There were 10 rounds of 80 or worse. Gary Koch shot 83. Lanny Watkins shot 86. You come in there, you shoot 74. Do you remember what it was like in that final round?
I remember pretty much every bit of it. I was paired with Joe Porter. Joe became one of my closest friends on tour. Joe ended up finishing second to Geiberger that week. The conditions weren't that hard for the last round. The problem was it was at Butler National. And they only had never played Butler National until the year before. It was a really hard course. It was harder than every other course on tour at that time. They don't play Butler. They stopped playing Butler for the Western Open, or what was the Western Open, because it's an all men's club and they couldn't do that anymore. But that was a great week. The other thing that was great about that week was I'm from Massachusetts originally, and I flew from Boston to Chicago for the tournament, and there was this really attractive flight attendant on the flight on TWA, and I started talking to her in the back of the plane, and she's in the next room right now. We've been married for 47 years at this.
Wow, that's a fantastic week.
Yeah, I met her that week. And actually, I think you said you were going to ask about the 1977 U.S. Open, Chris.
Yeah, that was my next question.
Yeah, well, that was our honeymoon. I got married the week before that U.S. Open. I had told her, if I qualify for the U.S. Open, I'm going to go to the U.S. Open with you. And if we don't, we'll have a honeymoon. And if I qualify, we'll have a honeymoon later. So our honeymoon was at the U.S. Open, which was kind of fun.
No doubt.
Yeah.
When I look back at that tournament at that Southern Hills, the heat that weekend was just off the charts. Hubert Greene would win that tournament, but he was dealing with death threats during the final round. That had to be a really strange couple of days. What do you remember about that weekend besides the honeymoon?
It was brutally hot. I've played in three tournaments in Oklahoma in my life. I played in the NCAA at Stillwater my senior year, and then I played the International JC Junior when I was 17 in Tulsa. And the two hottest tournaments I've ever played were both in Tulsa, the International JC Junior and that U.S. Open. I didn't wear a glove. And sometimes I wore tennis sweatbands to keep my hands a little drier when it was really hot. And that week, I not only wore tennis sweatbands, but on almost every tee, you know, we have water cooler on every tee on tour. I would soak the sweatbands in water to keep my hands cool to try to not sweat as much. You know, the other thing about me was in high school, I was voted most likely to break a sweat. So in that sort of weather, I was dripping out there.
How do you deal with that kind of heat, Bill? I mean, the dehydration, heat exhaustion, loss of focus. Those are things that can happen to us when it's just too darn hot and it's taking a toll on our bodies. We all know about Ken Venturi in 1964 when he was dealing with heat exhaustion and advised not to play in the final round because of the toll that the heat was taking on him. How do you maintain all of those things, your hydration and your focus, when you're dealing with that kind of heat?
Actually, that was never a problem for me. Even though I grew up in New England, I love playing in the heat. And I guess maybe because I worked out all the time, I was in good enough shape that I never had any problems at all in hot weather. I actually preferred it. So I managed. But yeah, it was pretty hot, I'll tell you that.
Were you anywhere near Hubert as he was dealing with all the death threats that had come his way?
No, I don't think any of us knew about it until the next day, actually. And the next tournament, the week after, was the Western Open again, where I had finished, you know, sixth the year before. And I saw Hubert on the practice tee on Tuesday, and he came out in the tee when I was already there hitting balls. I congratulated him on winning it, and he looked at me and he said, "Hey, I read about you," because they'd written about the honeymoon couple. And Hubert was so nice. He said, "You had as big a win last week as I did." I mean, I didn't know Hubert really well, but he was a good guy.
When you decided to walk away from the game and go back to med school, Jack Nicklaus wrote a letter of recommendation to the Ohio State Board of Directors. How did that come about?
Well, you know, I wasn't the greatest student. I was pulling every, ticket I could to try and get into med school. And I asked Jack to write a letter for me, and he did. And didn't work. I didn't get into Ohio State. I got into every med school I applied to except Ohio State and Stanford. I can understand Stanford, but Ohio State kind of puzzled me.
So you've been one of the top orthopedic surgeons for many years and shared your knowledge with Golf Digest and their readers since the 80s. Talk about marrying your knowledge of the game and your medical knowledge to help us understand what's going on in our golf swings.
Well, I've done a little of that. I wrote a number of papers about, you know, playing golf with hip arthroplasties or hip replacements or knee replacements when I was a resident. And I wrote this column for Golf Digest for about 15 years about golf injuries and playing with various problems. And I've written two books about, golf and medical problems and things like that. So I've tried to help, it's a tough thing to do. I mean, 'cause you're dealing with, people with all sorts of various mild injuries or medical diseases and problems from 10 to 80 and or 90. And still playing golf. So it's a big field.
I remember when Jack finished sixth in the 1998 Masters, and shortly thereafter, he actually had two hip replacements. Did you talk to Jack at all about what it was going to be dealing like, you know, trying to get back healthy, trying to play golf again after he had his hips replaced?
No, I did not. However, about 2 years after that, we had a symposium at the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery meeting on golfers and playing with hip and knee replacements. And the four people on the symposium was myself and Jack, and then Jimmy Andrews, you probably know, the great sports medicine doctor down in Alabama, and a guy named Ben Bierbaum. Well, Bierbaum is the guy that did Nicklaus's hip replacements and knee replacements. And I knew Ben fairly well by then already because he trained a couple of my partners. And that was a fun symposium. And I didn't really know Jack to any degree when I was on tour. I met him a couple times. I never played with him, but I got to spend a little time with him after the symposium talking to him. And, you know, that was fun.
Bill, in the past, you've weighed in on Tiger's health, and over the last few years, we've seen him struggle to even get through four rounds of golf. After he withdrew from the Genesis, he said he has two fused body parts now, and that's taking a toll on the other parts of his body that have to compensate for those fused parts. Do you think he's going to be able to compete and play four rounds of PGA Tour level golf and be a competitor and somebody who challenges for wins again, or is it more likely that he'll have a better chance to be competitive when he can go out on the Champions Tour and ride in a cart?
Well, it's tough. I mean, I don't think he's ever going to win again. You know, I know everybody says, no, this is Tiger. He can come back. Look what he did in 2019 at Augusta. But, you know, time is undefeated and biology is undefeated. He's got a lot of problems. Whenever you fuse a joint, the body then has to apply the forces that normally go through that joint to the adjacent joint or the next joint to it. And it puts the forces and stresses on that joint. And they're going to actually be worse because they're taking both the stresses from the fused joint and their own normal joint. So a lot of people get problems when they have fusions at the nearby joints. And it sounds like, I haven't talked to Tiger, I don't know him, but it sounds like he's saying, you know, he's going through that at this point.
You introduced me to Dennis Shadisher, and he is scheduled to join me on the show late in April. You guys have been friends for a long time. Tell everyone who Dennis is.
Well, Dennis is sort of my brother from another mother. He was on the Duke golf team with me. And we were always roommates on the road trips. But Dennis is kind of famous in golf. He played football at Duke, too. He was a captain and quarterback of the Duke football team. And he ended up trying to get on the PGA Tour. And when he was down in Florida, he played mini tours and roomed with Tom Kite and became one of Tom Kite's closest friends. And Kite nicknamed him Football. And Dennis Shadisher has been called Football to this day. Like, I never call him anything but that anymore. But he's, you know, one of my closest friends. I helped him get a couple of his early jobs in golf. And then he helped me get into medical school because he contacted the sports guys at Duke that he knew from football and told them to help me get in, and they did. So we sort of stroked each other's back on that. And again, I consider him brother from another mother. And he's one of the great guys in the whole world. If you don't like Dennis Shadisher, you need to go look in a mirror.
So you got to tell me about the Kentucky Fried Chicken bets that you guys had.
Yeah, when we were playing college golf, we both loved Kentucky Fried Chicken, so we had a standing bet every day. Whoever shot the low round, the other guy had to buy Kentucky Fried Chicken for him that night back in the hotel room. So we gorged on a few buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken, and Dennis loves to tell stories. He used to tell people, you know, he says, I was like a horse. He said, I put my face in the bucket, and there was grease dripping off it everywhere. It's a little exaggerated. I wasn't quite that bad. But I'll tell you what I did was Dennis got remarried about, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. And a lovely lady who's actually had a catering service, and she's a chef, you know, she's a, you know, high level chef. So when I heard he was getting married, he said, oh, I got to get him a small gift. So I sent him a $50 gift certificate for Kentucky Fried Chicken, which I'm sure she appreciated.
That's great, Bill. Before I let you go, you're a wonderful follow on Twitter. Let our listeners know how they can find you out there on social media.
Yeah, I do Twitter. I don't do Facebook or Instagram. I'm on Instagram, but I don't ever do it. But my handle's BamBam1729 at BamBam1729. BamBam is from the Flintstones character, of course, and I do Twitter. I do some medical stuff, some golf stuff, but a lot of Olympic stuff is on there too. So
you got to be looking forward to the summer games, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it's going to be great going to Paris for these, because the last few games, you know, Sochi, Russia, and then Beijing, China, and then Tokyo, although Tokyo is great, it was right at the end of the COVID pandemic, so we really couldn't do anything, and we were very restricted. So it's going to be fun to get back to a normal Olympics, especially in a city like Paris. My wife that I mentioned before was an international flight attendant for TWA for most of the time. And she flew to Paris all the time. It's her favorite city. So she's going with me and she can't wait.
Well, Bill, I can't thank you enough for taking time out of your night to come back and be a part of the show this week. I hope we get the privilege of catching up with you maybe right after the Olympics to get your thoughts, your feedback in the Olympic golf as well. You're fantastic, my friend.
Well, I appreciate it, Chris. It's a fun to talk to you, and hopefully we'll do it again.
Take care, Bill. All the best to you and your family. Look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Thank you. Bye.
See you, Bill. That is the great Bill Mallon. Again, at BamBam1729 is where you can find him out on Twitter. He is just so fantastic. The things that you get to learn in the stories and from this time on tour and prior to tour and hearing about his relationship with his caddy, Chris Greeley, and just everything that he has meant to the game of golf and now to the orthopedic world. He's just a fantastic resource and a fantastic guy. I can't thank him enough for coming back and being a part of the show. Hopefully we get the opportunity to catch up with him after the Olympics a little bit later on this summer, because I'd love to get his 2 cents on if he gets an opportunity to go out and see the Olympic golf. But just overall, like I say, he's an Olympic historian. So a lot of great stories there. So looking forward to catching up with him, like I say, hopefully in a couple of months. Okay, joining me next is going to be former PGA Tour pro Scott Gumpen. And Scott had a tremendous playing career from his time as a young player to college to being the medalist at the 87 U.S. Amateur to winning out on the Space Coast Tour and then out on the PGA Tour as well. Looking forward to having Scott join me. He's going to join me, like I say, in just a moment. But before he does, I was talking with Eddie Dry, VP of Domestic Sales for Strixon Cleveland Golf, at the PGA Merchandise Show earlier this year. And I said, Eddie, I like your CBX full-face wedges. How can they help an average player like me play better? Here's what he had to say.
An average player, I use one, and I'm in some lies that you can't even believe. And I need all the help I can get. And the face is bigger, and the grooves go all the way up and all the way out to the toe. So if you hit it on the toe, you miss it, bam, there's a groove. So I like that. So I carry a 58.
There you have it, folks. Try the new CBX full-face wedges from Cleveland Golf. I also want to give a shout-out to my friends over at On Point Golf and their great On Point ball marker. Get the number one ball marker in the game of golf. On Point is the only three-dimensional ball marker out there. With alignment technology and a removable coin that is approved to use according to the rules of golf. As you know, putting is all about line and pace. Mark your ball with OnPoint, engage with your three-dimensional ball marker, and have more confidence in your line, execute the putt, and you're going to lower your scores. Do what the likes of Jim Furyk, PGA professionals, and amateurs alike are doing now. They use the number one ball marker in golf, and they lower their scores. You know Ken Duke and Thongchai JD. They won for the first time on the PGA Tour in 2023, and they were using an OnPoint ball marker. Get yours at onpointgolf.us and make more putts. And oh, by the way, you can also customize the removable coin for any club, event, or corporate outing. They make really great tee gifts and custom products. That's also going to help lower your score. I use OnPoint ball markers. Mine is black and gold, 3D black golf ball with a gold line down the middle to help me line up my putts. It's like having a 15th club in my bag. It's helped my game. Why wouldn't you let it help yours? Again, onpointgolf.us. See what I'm talking about. Order yours today. Now let's talk grips. I want to tell you about Lambkin grips. Every shot, as you know, has its own unique feel. The trick? Feel comfortable with each one. And comfort is built into the very DNA of Sonar Plus Black grips. Composed of their Genesis material that provides supreme comfort and durability, with their fingerprint technology, creates a strong connection and unforgettable touch. The game changes from shot to shot. The feel on your hand shouldn't. Lambkin, feel is everything. All right, now making his next On the Tee debut with me is former PGA Tour pro Scott Gump. Scott is from Merritt Island, Florida, which is over near Melbourne on the Space Coast. He was an All-American and helped Brevard County Community College win the national championship before moving on to the University of Miami. He was a medalist at the 1987 U.S. Amateur, turned pro in 1988. He has 6 professional wins, 3 on what's now the Korn Ferry Tour, plus the 1989 Mobile Tournament on the U.S. Golf Tour, plus 2 more on the Space Coast Tour. He finished as the leading money winner on the Space Coast Tour in 1989. He finished 3rd at Q School in 1990 and started his PGA Tour career in 91. He was one of only 5 true rookies to keep his tour card in that 91 season, finished 2nd in the 1999 Players' Championship, just 2 strokes back at David Duval, and over the course of his playing career. On top of those six wins, he's had three runner-up finishes and 29 top tens. Following his playing days, he's become a wonderful coach. He did it at the Gary Gilchrist Golf Academy and plus spent some time as an assistant coach at Notre Dame. And I'm very excited I get to have him with me this week here on Next on the Tee. Hey, Scott, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you so much. Yes, I just dialed in on my phone. So sorry for the delay.
No worries.
Here we are.
Here we are. All right. Scott, before we get started in talking about all the golf stuff, I got to ask you, you and I are roughly the same age. You're about 8 months younger than I am. Outside of golf, I'm a bit of a space nut. You're born not far from Kennedy Space Center. Did you get to see, growing up, did you get to see the Apollo launches, the space shuttle launches? Were you interested in any of that stuff?
Well, funny you should ask. What's pretty wild is my dad worked for the Department of Defense side. So he actually showed up at Cape Canaveral, Cape Kennedy, back in 1958. So literally, and my mom worked out at the Cape. So literally, my family was, you know, one of the first people there, not really the first. So growing up on the island, you know, many, many, many launches, you know, of course, when you have your dad working there, you're fascinated by it. He actually worked for Department of Defense, putting up, all sorts of government satellites. And the funny family story is, when he was working, he was, not working on the payload, just more the rocket that would send up the satellite. And they said, whatever you do, you're not even allowed to look up at the satellite while you're working on the rocket that pushes it forward. Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, I tell you, Donnie Hammond is a wonderful friend of the show. And Donnie's also a space nut. We will be texting each other anytime there's a launch. And sometimes he shares some video. He lives over in Orlando. So sometimes I'll go over to the coast and video it and send it to me, or he may just go in his backyard, because obviously from Orlando you can still see the smoke plume and everything else going up. So we both enjoy that part very much.
Yeah, it's fascinating, unbelievable.
Scott, winning medalist honors during the stroke play portion of the U.S. Amateur in 87, what is a tremendous feat, especially with the 288 guys that were in the field that time around. You end up taking it by two strokes. What do you remember about that portion of the tournament?
Oh my, that is going back in time a little bit. What I remember the most, it was very much a formative, you know, moment in tournament. The story I since moved on and try to share with my college players and just anyone who will listen. It was a funny thing, because the previous year I went and played at Shoal Creek at the USAM, and I qualified and I was there, and I was trending up. I was a good player. I was playing well. And then, you know, the old big event itis, or whatever you want to call it, all of a sudden, oh wow, this is really important. What am I going to do? I started trying harder. Oh, and now everything was important and everything was vital. And oh my goodness, I was all worked up. And I remembered very specifically, my parents were wonderful. They traveled with me. They were there, and I started getting snippy with them a little bit and on edge and all that. I went out and shot a million. I don't even know what I shot, but it was high. And I was so frustrated from that, that when I had the wonderful opportunity to go play another USAM, this time in Jupiter Hills, Florida, you know, no one really taught me this, but I was just there at the event and I was having a nice summer and here we go again. And then I started having those feelings, oh, I really got to try now. I really got to play well. Then it dawned on me, and this is my why I became a PGA Tour player. I was like, oh no. Oh, no, 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 I'm not going to do that again. Then the true, you know, reasoning of my brain happened. It's like, I don't care if I finish dead last in the tournament. I don't really care. I do care if I win, but I am not going to try harder, put it on a pedestal, make it more than it is, you know, really overdo the game because I became worse every time I did that. So I'm like, I don't, you know, okay, I'm going to accept how I play and I'm just going to go forward. And then sure enough, that gave, as we all know, it gave me freedom. And I wasn't so concerned, not trying to play perfect and all that gibberish that really gets in the way from just trying to do the best you can with the shot in front of you. So it was pretty ironic that once I took that mentality of freedom and let's go and let's just do whatever happens is going to happen. I might as well get on with it. Boom, presto, you know, the Finnish medalist. I still have the medal that the USGA gives you. I'm pretty proud of that one. Because, you know, I know there's 287 other guys that are really trying that week. I know they all really want to get the match play. So it was a cool honor.
So were you able to carry that mentality forward through the rest of your playing career? Cause you got into a lot of big tournaments after that.
I wish. Yes and no. Yes and no. I call it the autopsy. When I go back and, you know, look over my career longevity, you know, for me, I played really well in some mini tour golf. I played well that summer after that USAM, by the way, and I'll tell another story, but I won four tournaments in a row after the USAM. I'm actually, as a player, I'm more proud of that than I am the USAM because just to continue playing well. I finished second on the money list on the Korn Ferry Tour 1 year. And then I did finish 40th on the PGA Tour money list. Was my best year. So I look back and those years that I really did play well, yes, I did have that mentality. Believe it or not, I call it, I was just more comfortable in my skin. And I had huge debates with the other coach at Notre Dame. That he didn't believe me. Oh, you're always trying to get better and 1% better. And I understand that motivational philosophy. But for me, I just took it. What I needed is to take it down a notch. So the times I look back and the years that I played well consistently is the years that I just did maintenance. And now you always got to work on your fundies. That never ends. But then more importantly, I just felt like I was good enough. I didn't have to manically improve something. And when I look back now, I understand the psyche is I was believing in myself and I was comfortable and, you know, I felt like I belonged. So yeah, I did take that. And then when I played poorly and I'd lose my card or play mediocre, oh no, I was trying hard. I was grinding on the money list. I was all concerned. I've got to do this and I've got to do that. And it just became overwhelming. Some people use all those thoughts and feelings as true motivation. But I was on the case. I wanted it so badly that I always had to take it down a notch. So there you go.
Your play at that USAM got you into the 1988 Masters. Do you remember your first Masters appearance?
Oh, I do very much. And the story to get to the Masters really, really, you know, tied in for me because I'm a golf geek. I'm on steroids, a golf geek. I used to tape the Masters on the old, you know, cassette tapes and sit there and rewatch them and that's why I just love the game. So the fact that a golf geek who was not the best junior in the world, and all of a sudden I'm moving up the ranks. Now all of a sudden I've got a 4-footer to get into the semis, because back then the final four got in the Masters. You know, I had this 4-footer. All of a sudden I'm like, if I make this putt, I'm going to Augusta. And of course I want to, you know, keep winning, but you know, that's a pretty cool carrot. And Shockingly, I'll never forget it. And that's another thing that I have this sense in my brain, my competitive brain. I remembered the putt. It was like a 4-footer or so. And I just, and you know, I, then again, I could have made it a big deal and, you know, triangulate, walk around it four times and, you know, overplay, overdo, but something dawned on me. Yeah, that's cool. But, you know, I just like knocking in 4-foot putts. I love the challenge of it. So it's crazy to me that I flipped gears and I'm just like, I don't like missing putts. I like knocking it in. So it wasn't the mystery, you know, prize months away. It was just like right here, right now. I like knocking in 4-footers. Of course, it meant the world to me. But for some reason, sometimes in my career, other times not, I flipped a gear and I just went into, you know, my training and the joy of just trying to knock in a putt. Yes,
you did.
I did. And then going to Augusta as an amateur, amazing, amazing. You know, really a thrill. I stayed up in the crow's nest the whole week. Just had a wonderful experience. The hospitality there to sneak up into the champions locker room and everything. For me, my funny golfing story is, believe it or not, I even kept score. I actually got a chance to play with Gary Player in a practice round, and only an amateur would keep score in a practice round. And I remember I shot 68, not to whoopee-doo, because the pins are in the middle and it's not a big deal. But for me, I'm like, yeah, I'm getting into this. I went and played the par 3, and I'll never forget it, that as of Augusta, especially back then, they mowed the greens every day. They got faster. And they weren't quite tournament speed, but then on Wednesday on the par 3, and of course I was another moron, I wanted to compete in the par 3, so I tried to bring my juices. And so I was taking it serious, and then I had some 20-footer on about the third hole, and I'll never forget that one. I tried. I was locked in, dialed in, got over it, hit, I thought, a pretty good putt, and I hit it like 10 feet by the hole. And it spooked me. It scared me. And all of a sudden, whoa, because I was locked in. I wasn't just taking it casual. And that really threw my confidence for a loop. You know, I should have saved that energy and I did other years and stuff, but I learned my lesson kind of the hard way. I went out and shot a million, played with Charlie Cootie round one, which was a blast. You know, shot my amateur high score, but at the same time, I didn't mind because it was the Masters.
So you got to tell me, what's it like up there in the crow's nest? I've always wondered.
Very small. It is very intimate. It is hilariously, it is what you would think. It's steeped in tradition. I remembered after playing a practice round, you kind of go up these really narrow steps. And it's online. There's some videos of it and stuff, but it's just these little rooms with these lovely, comfortable little beds. And I remembered walking up the steps thinking, well, this is my spot for the week. And sure enough, Jerry Pate is sitting up there talking. I don't remember who he was with, but he was reminiscing and hanging out and doing everything. And he was extremely respectful. Oh, so sorry. I know this is your spot this week. So sorry. But again, that just, you know, it was for me, I'm a golf geek. My God, Jerry Pate, you got to be kidding me. I mean, how cool is that? Just, you know, silly little stuff like that, that just means the world to somebody like me playing at, you know, Merritt Island, Florida, which didn't even have a golf course on Merritt Island at the time I was growing up, you know, to be able to be at Augusta and to stay up there. So it's a very quaint and neat little area, probably a funny side bit is when you're an amateur, you actually have to pay to keep your amateur status. Boy, times have changed. And so I remembered I got the bill for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it was, I'd have to go back and look it up. I know I kept a receipt, but it was like $4 for breakfast, $5 for lunch, and, you know, $7 for dinner or something. It was quite an experience. I really loved it.
You made it through Q school in 1990. You finished third in what was a loaded field. Duffy Waldorf was the medalist. John Inman, who joined me on the show a couple of weeks ago, finished second. But you know, Brandel Chambly and John Daly, Jerry Haas. I mean, I could go on. The great, great field that week. And to finish third for 6 rounds of golf against a field like that, is another tremendous feat. What do you remember about that experience?
Oh man, even more. I tell you what, it's, there's so many formative years for any professional. That one really stood out. I was becoming a little more polished. I was becoming a little more mature. It took me a while, but I'll never forget it. And I should know my first two round scores. I either shot 73, 73, 74, 72, or I don't know, something not
73, 73.
There you go. It wasn't the best, but I'll never forget it that my coach, Dr. Abel was there. And he came over on the putting green after those two rounds. Didn't play horrible, but just was, you know, I was feeling it, but just wasn't quite there. And I remembered he gave me one little tip. And we hit some putts out into space and one little thing. And sure enough, I go shoot, what did I shoot? 67, 65, 68, 70 to end up finishing third. And I'll never forget it. Is the fact that I was open to being coached. That's what I take away. That, you know, I was open to someone. So, you know, I just noticed something. You may want to, here, let's do a little drill and, you know, kind of see if you can feel that a little bit. And I was just calm enough and I wasn't so emotionally attached that I was able to absorb the lesson. And it was a quick lesson. Because, you know, you're teeing off the next day. I remembered shooting the 65, 67. That was huge. But I remembered being so nervous going into that final round. I figured I could shoot like 80 or something and get my card. But, I mean, that wasn't off the table. I was so nervous about, you know, messing up my opportunity. Because the previous year, you know, I missed my card by one shot.
Oh.
In Houston. Yeah. You know, that leaves a bit of a scar. And then playing on the Hogan Tour all year. Yeah, that was a wild. So to back up just a fraction here, I am in El Paso, Texas, and the PGA Tour, bless their hearts, they care about you, but they don't really care. And I don't mean that in a negative way, but it's just how it is out there. The point is, first stage of Q school was like the next week or 2 weeks after the final Hogan Tour event finishes. I had to finish 50th in order to be exempt. So I remembered if I had to make the cut. And if I had to make the cut, then I'd have a chance to finish 50th on the money list. I finished 50th, then I can drive my van back to Florida versus having to fly to Florida, go immediately into, you know, the first Q school. I remembered I made like a 6'8" footer on 17 and like another 6'8" footer on 18 to make the cut on the number, and ends up, I can go back and look it up. I think I made it by like $34 or something.
Wow.
So that enabled me to exhale, and then get in. And I was, for some crazy reason, I was a good first stage, second stage guy. I made it through a lot of those. I think I made it through six or seven in a row or whatever. All a blur. But more importantly, you know, that I made those putts, but then I grew as a player because knowing I could handle the pressure of you have to execute right now. There's no tomorrow. You have to somehow, you know, suck it up and get the job done. We finished 50th. That gave me a breather, made it through second stage, go to finals, start poorly. But as opposed to panicking, I just stayed the course, you know, kept on playing, and sure enough, get my card. 516 events later, you know, I had a wonderful career. It's crazy to think, you know, if I would have been all panicky and oh no, and really down on myself, you know, I may even have had a PGA Tour career. Who knows?
Later on in that 1990 season, you set the course record at the Woodland Country Club during the New England Classic. You and Barry Cheeseman, who was on the show a few weeks ago, shot 66 in the second round. It must have been a brutal course or brutal weather conditions, because there were a lot of rounds shot in the upper 70s and low 80s. I know Barry shot 81 in the first round. Brandel Chamblee, who would go on to win that week, shot 78 in the second round. What do you recall about that week and going out there and then setting the course record?
I do remember a little bit. What I do remember is that round I shot was in the morning. It was a new golf course with fairly new greens. I can't remember if the course was new or the greens were new. The greens became, I do remember the greens were cement. They were so firm that it just hitting a green, I do remember that was like a miracle. So it really became like landing your, you know, 8-iron on in the parking lot. It would just go bouncing all around. But early in the morning with the dew and just, you know, things weren't drying out as much. The moisture held just a little bit. And I do remember that. It was a very unique round. I mean, for me to even to back it up and to be at the very first, the Ben Hogan, you know, in Bakersfield, California, to actually end up playing in the very first, you know, Hogan Tour tournament, even that whole year, was pretty wild. I actually got married to my lovely bride, Chrissy. We got married in May, and I always love when I hear some of my college guys and all that, they play 2-3 events and they're just exhausted. Oh my God, coach. Whew, that was a lot of golf. Chrissy and Cheesy, Cheeseman will, you know, and everyone will agree in this. So we got married in Cocoa Beach at the Cocoa Beach Hilton. We got in our van and we came back, I think, in October. You know, we were on the road from May to whenever the heck, you know, whenever El Paso was. We didn't come home. I mean, there was no home. I mean, it was life on the road. So, yeah, I remember, you know, seeing John Daly in Reno pulling the slot machine things. I remember we did a caravan.
No doubt.
Oh yeah, caravan with Tom Lehman out in you know, going from I totally forget. We're going through Albuquerque, New Mexico, and that whole area, going, I think, from somewhere in Texas to somewhere, who knows? Just, you know, traveling the country, enjoying the challenges and the beautiful spots and the really interesting characters, and you know, I wouldn't have it to do all over again. We really enjoyed it.
You also played extremely well that season at the international tournament with the modified Stableford system. You would finish tied for second with Ian Baker Finch and Bob Lord just behind Jose Maria Olazabal. What do you remember about that week, and what are your thoughts about using the modified Stableford system?
I did, I think. It's a very strange situation for me. I love Denver every time I go there. And I'm like, what a spectacular place. Jack Nicklaus course, Castle Pines. I cannot picture a course that fits me worse. I am more of a short, you know, consistent. I would not, you know, I did not launch the ball. I was, you know, middle. I think my first year on tour, you can look at it, I was maybe in the middle. Distance wise, I got shorter and shorter. Everyone else got longer. This Castle Pines is a bomber's paradise. It's classic Nicklaus. You got to hit it high and soft, you know, all the things. But for some reason, I think I played there, I'd have to go back, I don't know, six or eight times. I don't think I ever missed the cut, or maybe I missed the cut there once. I did fall in love with it. I think I was just enthused because of how beautiful it is. I think the golf course, you know, every shot was visually, it's like playing Pebble. It's like the shots are just right there in front of you, even though I thought they're really hard. You know, I just kind of embraced the week. I do remember Chrissy and I, my wife, we have a lot of funny, just cute little travel stories. I was playing a pro-am in Detroit. So we went to Dallas early because I think the PGA was a week prior. Maybe not. I'm not sure. It's a blur. Anyways, for some reason, I decided to go to Denver early and we go play a practice round. And then I get on a plane and go play my pro-am, then come back and play the Tuesday practice round. But while we were out there, Chrissy decided to walk with me. She caddied on the Hogan Tour, by the way. And I was in the final group at Q School. She put the pin in and at 18 in Palm Springs, and that was it. She did not carry that bag any further. She was done with that. But anyways, we were in in Denver, and we came across this beautiful, it was a lovely evening, afternoon of golf. And we walk up, and there's like these herd, I don't know if it's a herd, a gaggle of little baby turkeys. And they were so cute. And one of the nice homeowners there was just kind of out in his lawn, and he pointed out, and we just started a quick conversation, and it was just so cute and neat. And they were all running around, and that's part of the thing that I love about golf is the places you go, they're so beautiful. So literally for, you know, I'm 35 years, I'm still taking a picture of a turkey when I see him. And that's like our thing. Cause you know, when I travel all around, and I'm not a bird watcher like John Edmund, but I'll invariably, when I see a turkey, it's like Chrissy and I's thing. So to go back there, and it was a long week. And then probably my funny story was coming down the stretch. I just missed a birdie on the 18th hole. That maybe would have either tied aloft the ball or whatever the score would have been. But I remember my drive went out in the fairway, and I walk up, and I had the exact same yardage that I had in a Tuesday match that I played with some buddy of mine's, actually, Bart and Brad Bryant versus Steve LaMontagne and I. We'd always play a match for a lot of Tuesdays. And my caddy looked at me and goes, Gump, I think we had this yardage before. And, you know, we had a quick, you know, chuckle. And, well, I know what to do here. I mean, I didn't flinch for once. It's just, yeah, it's a magical spot, mainly because I kept my card because of that finish. Because up to that, I really hadn't done a whole lot. But that literally, again, started my career, you know, further on the PGA Tour.
You kept it going the following week because you finished tied for fifth at the Walt Disney World Classic, thanks to shooting three rounds in the 60s. You were clearly riding some good momentum and tremendous play. Talk about playing so well and what must have been a home game for you.
Oh my gosh. See, now you're really kicking the cobwebs here on the old memory banks. That was the last tournament of the year, I believe. But more importantly for me, I was 14 or 15 years old. So my parents asked me, what would I like for my birthday? My birthday's in December. I said, go, you know, Dad, if I could go play the Disney courses, I heard that they only charge like $10 to play if, you know, an adult goes with you in a cart. Even playing in a golf cart was like a big deal because, you know, back then we walked. Oh my gosh, I never played in a cart. So I have vivid memories of my dad, who was not a golfer. He would get in the cart with me, and we went over and played the Magnolia. And again, I'm near Disney. I'm enjoying the golf. I wasn't any good, but I was having fun. Lots of joy, lots of laughter, you know. And then all of a sudden, my rookie year, not that many years later, to shoot 67 in the final. Welcome to the PGA Tour, by the way. If you can look it up. I was three shots out of the lead coming into the final round. And you're always kind of like, well, if I can post a number, it's, you know, you got a shot. You never, I don't know. I'm young and dumb. I didn't know what I was doing. I go out and shoot 67, playing with David Peoples. Went to go out and shoot 67, lose by three. Welcome to the PGA Tour. Amira, I think, shot 64 and, you know, promptly beat up on everyone. But yeah, everyone thinks, oh, the players are really good now. Before, maybe they were just okay. Maybe there's a couple of good players. I'm like, well, okay, if you say so. But really, to be kind of a home game for me to get my card, you know, I played the Orlando Land Junior Golf Association. Yeah, I didn't even, it long since didn't exist. But for me to be able to play that tour, it was just a beginner tour. But I'll never forget that. How did I fall in love with this game? My parents found this tour. They drove me over from Merritt Island. Oh gosh, I was probably like 15, maybe. Played like Buena Vista. We show up because of traffic, a little late. I throw on my shoes, run to the tee. I'll never forget this one. Shoot 78, finish third in like my bracket. I just thought I'd won the Masters and the U.S. Open at the same time. you know, when you think about it nowadays, oh, how many AJGA's events did you win? Or, you know, what's wrong with you, son? You three putted to only shoot 70 on the final hole. You okay? You know, my training was joy. I shot 78 at, now we call it Birdie Vista, Lake Buena Vista, because remember the tour used to play there. I shot 64 there in the tour event. And that was a lot of fun. But think about it back then, but my 78, I got this little trophy and I just thought, this is a blast. Where do I sign up for more? Did I beat anyone? No. Did I beat the golf course? No. But my energy was like, well, this is, I like this. And there you go. That's how I literally became a tour player, just because of that sort of stuff.
Scott, we're on the heels of the Players Championship in 99. You finished second there to David Duval. Speaking of playing a home game, he was from Jacksonville. You trailed him by 8 strokes going into the final 2 rounds, but you make a nice weekend charge. What was it like playing out on that course, playing in that tournament, trying to chase down the hometown favorite and almost pulling it off?
That week, again, because of the finish and the different memories, never forget that one. Now, this one is further along. Say my first tour event was 1991. By then, I'd played a good many tournaments, some successful, some not. I'd survived. I kept my card, won on the Corn Ferry, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, now at that point, I'm becoming a little more crusty. I'm a little more wise. I know how the courses go and everything else. I'll never forget this one. Walk up there, I believe it was Monday. Usually I'd show up, you know, in the late afternoon on Monday to kind of putt and chip and just kind of get the feel for what's going on for the week. I'll never forget it. I take my 2 golf balls and drop them on the green and they literally bounced. And you're like, oh my, okay, this week's going to be a little different. It ends up, if you'll see, Duval and I were the only 2 guys to break par.
Right.
At the same golf course, like this week, 20 under. And that's what was funny for me watching guys, you know, back up 6 irons at the beginning of this week. I'm like, ooh, yeah, that's a different product there. So for me, it really was survival of, you know, that was such a survival week that I felt like I played in 5 US Opens. Unfortunately, I never really played all that well, but I did experience them. But that was, you know, absolutely for me, it was like my US Open, that I happened to be playing well and I wasn't overplaying and I was just getting on with my game. I'll really fast forward. A lot of people, it was on TV. I aimed at the middle of the green on 17. And unfortunately, I landed almost dead in the middle of the green. If anyone knows that green, it's dead flat. My ball landed up top. It's flat up there. My ball went over the green. Everyone, well, and then I hit some wedge and I was able to 2-putt for my double. And a lot of people want to talk about boo hoo hoo. Oh, you're really kind of, wow, man, if only you would have. And I'm like, I don't think so, because I went birdie, birdie, double, and then I birdied 18 also. So for me, it's kind of like, you know, I was pretty fortunate to make those other birdies. I'm not really going to, you know, beat myself up too much.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Scott, just a couple more before I let you go. And in 99, you were also in the field at the Open Championship at Carnoustie. Yeah. There were 11 other players from the Orlando area that were a part of that field. Most of them were heading home on Saturday, thanks to about 30-mile-an-hour wind gusts that were all over the golf course that day. What do you remember about trying to tame Carnoustie and deal with the winds?
Well, any golf course that would make arguably the best balls, top 10 ball strikers, I think. There'd be a lot of debate for this one. But Sergio Garcia, arguably one of the better ball strikers, literally was crying after his 2 rounds. Me, on the other hand, I have a bit of an asterisk beside it. I caught a flu or a bug or something. I remember I did rent a house and my agent and my caddy were staying with me and everything. And I remember sleeping in my jeans. I was shivering so much. Wow. I went to, you know, went to the doc and I got the pills and all that and the penicillin or whatever they gave me. And I was kind of like, well, I'm here. What's the worst thing I can do? Miss the cut? Okay. The first nine holes, I believe I shot 46. So the wildest part is, if I got to look back, see how many I missed the cut by. I shot 46 for nine holes and legitly still had a shot at making the cut. To me, that was wild. I hit one tee shot about 3 foot off the fairway and a marshal was right there looking for it and they never did find it. It was wow. One of the thickest rough, the Hogan par five. What is that? Number six with the bunker in the middle. And the story goes, he'd aim left of the bunker right next to the out of bounds. That layup, my caddy and I, we walked it up. Say you hit a 3 wood or a driver out there and then just want to hit 5-6 iron. You get out there. And I think it was like 12 yards wide and firm. And the hay was so thick. I mean, it was borderline lost ball. It was the wildest setup I'd ever played in. It was wild. And then the Vondeveld, I mean, that just kind of, you know, capped off a crazy week. I enjoyed it. I wish I would have played in others. But that's life.
I'm staring at a Scott Gump card pro set put out in 1991. I imagine you've got a few of those laying around the house. What's it like the first time you see yourself on a trading card?
Very unique, very unusual. There were 2 years, I guess, my rookie year and then first year. Believe it or not, in this day and age, you can find anyone. I still receive those cards to sign. A lot of people collect them and they want to try to get the signatures, either collect them or sell them or, hey, it's, you know, it's free market, it's free world out there. Not a year has gone by since 1992 that I hadn't received a card in the mail and they send us a, you know, stamped, envelope and then I mail it back to them. It's surreal, especially because, you know, baseball and all that and the other sports have collectible cards, but golf, that was only two years, correct?
All right. That's right.
3 years. So yeah, very unique, very unique. I'm very humbled. My kids' kids, hopefully we'll see it someday.
I hope so too. Yeah. Scott, before I let you go, tell everybody what you're doing now.
Well, after I was done playing, I wanted to keep my competitive juices going. And then I decided to, the whole college coaching thing. I did that for 9 years, the University of Notre Dame. You can put it on my tombstone. At one point our team was ranked about 100th. And at one point I recruited hard. That was my new competition. And I got them up to rank 5th in the country. While we had a team GPA of 3.6 at a school, which I didn't know. I graduated from the University of Miami. Notre Dame is arguably, debatably, just one step below Ivy League. The level of intelligence and drive and just everything, the kids there and the young adults are just, it's an amazing place. So for me to recruit, and oh, it snows there, by the way. So the recruiting elements, I had no idea what I was getting into. So I was really, really proud of that. Then I decided to hang my hat on that and move back to Florida, be closer to my family. And now I am doing some college placement. I'm on the other side. I was a recruiter guy. Now I'm helping out families. But actually, my real love is, believe it or not, I'm a caddy.
Is that right?
The guy by the name of Davis Chatfield is a kid I recruited from Massachusetts. Nobody really, really wanted him. I watched him play, and I'm like, I need players like you. I think he's tough as nails. I recruited him. He played great. Literally, he chipped in on the last hole to help us win our home tournament. He does stuff like that. He graduated, turned pro, and I texted him last year. Congrats on, hey man, way to go. He was one of only 4 players to make it through pre-qualifier, first stage, second stage, finished finals, top 40 at finals. That got him fully exempt, or, you know, somewhat exempt. And I just for fun said, hey, man, I'll caddy for you. And he said, really? Oh, my gosh, I'd love for you to do that. So I went out and caddied for him all last year in the Corn Ferry. It was a blast. He finished 62nd on the money list. Yeah, I'm a junkie. I mean, I can't help myself. And then right now, actually, he just played the foreign tournaments on the Corn Ferry. And then I just texted him again, and the band is getting back together. So we're going to go again this year, and I'm going to enjoy my competitive golf. I love it. I'm just happy I don't have to swing and hit the dang ball. I get to do it, hit the ball. So I'm happy.
That's great stuff. Scott, how can our listeners stay up to date with all the great things you're doing? Are you out there online or on social media?
I am not a whole lot. I'm more of a follower. I have to be honest with you. I am not. I'm on Instagram. I follow all my other golfers. But no, not really. Probably the best thing you can do is watch the telecast there on the Corn Ferry Tour, and I'm sure I'll give a wave to the camera as hopefully Chatty's holding trophies.
I hope so too. Well, Scott, it's been fantastic having you as part of the show this week. I hope I get the privilege of catching up with you again sometime.
Oh, anytime, Chris. Please, we'll connect, and I'm sure I'll have some more stories from the tour.
I look forward to hearing all of those. Take care, Scott. All the best to you and your family. Hopefully we get to catch up with you again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks for everything.
Thanks, Scott.
All right, bye-bye.
That is the great Scott Gumb. How great is that guy? Right. I love the attitude that he talked about and how he carried that forward. He really did carry it forward throughout the rest of his playing days and playing carefree. Right. How many times have we placed too much importance on a shot, on a hole, on a group of holes, on a round of golf? And it just ruined everything. It ruined the day. It ruined how we played. It ruined how we felt about it afterwards. And looking back on it, Scott's attitude is just fantastic. I love that so much. And hopefully We'll catch up with some of those other things, but what a fantastic career he had in the game. And now continuing that on, I love the fact I'm a junkie, but he's now out there caddying for a young guy that he recruited. I think that's a tremendous story in and of itself. So hopefully we get the privilege of having Scott back on the show a little bit later on this year. All right, folks, it is time for me to put a bow on this edition of Next on the Tee. My sincere thanks again to Bill Mallon and Scott Gumb for joining me this week. Scheduled to join me next week are, you heard Scott mention David Peoples. Well, David Peoples is going to be back with me again next week, as will Tom Pertzer, two great PGA Tour pros and great friends of this show. Really excited to have them back on the same show next week. I'll also get a visit from Jihae Lee from Sportsbox AI. She's going to make her Next on the Tee debut with me. I hear the software that they have is absolutely outstanding. I can't wait to hear all about it. We'll round out next week's show with a visit from Caddy Hall of Famer Dennis Cohn. He has been a wonderful friend and supporter of this show for many, many years. Excited to have Dennis back as part of the show. Quick reminder that you can find this show available as a podcast just about anywhere you get your podcast content. In particular, we're out there on the Pittsburgh Tribune Review site. Just go to triplive.com and click on sports. You're going to find the show on the homepage of their sports section. You can also find us out on Good Pods, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Audio Boom. Again, just about anywhere you get your podcast content, just type in Next on the Tee in the search bar. We're probably on whatever your favorite podcast app is. But my thanks to the folks over at Good Pods for making this show one of their recommended podcasts. So please download their free app and stream your favorite podcast right there on your favorite device. But as always, most of all, my sincere thanks to all of you for being the greatest supporters in the history of podcasts. I appreciate you all so very much. Until next week, hit 'em straight, my friends.